Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for most of this morning, it's special coverage of the Trump and Putin summit that is now ending as we analyze what it means in the context of U.S. national security, the Russian hacking of our elections with the indictments on Friday, the very public rupture last week between Trump and the NATO allies, not to mention the future of people in Syria and much more. We are awaiting the Trump-Putin news conference, which is expected to start any time now. Our special guests coming up include the editor of The New Yorker and longtime Russia watcher David Remnick, and President Bush's former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, who has a new book very relevant to the Russian hacking issue called Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age. So David Remnick and Michael Chertoff both coming up. And a special guest right now, the editor of The Nation and longtime Russia watcher, Katrina VandenHeuvel. She spearheaded a letter going into this summit signed by all kinds of progressive royalty, you might call them, from Noam Chomsky to Alice Walker to Michael Moore to Gloria Steinem to Daniel Ellsberg, Reverend William Barber, Pat Schroeder, and others. The letter called for a pronounced shift in U.S. policy toward Russia. But in this group's case, that doesn't just mean being tougher on them, and it elevates the risk of nuclear war to a top concern that hasn't been so much in the headlines. Katrina, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for noting the open letter which The Nation put forward last week as an intervention at this time. You know, it takes very seriously the open letter, the reports of Russian interference in the 2016 election, and it calls for fortifying our democracy infrastructure for the electoral process. It's an urgent need of protection. We understand that there needs to be proactive steps taken. But at the same time, the need for addressing the nuclear danger, which is very real, is vital. And I think the open letter challenges the false choice between taking effective action to safeguard our elections, our democracy, and trying to improve relations, certainly on the nuclear front, between the U.S. and Russia. Because if we want democracy to flourish in our country, if our country's conflicts with Russia escalate into a nuclear war, as the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which moved the doomsday clock closer from 11:57 to 11:58:30, midnight represents nuclear apocalypse. It did that earlier this year. Our country will be greatly endangered. So that was, and I would simply say, yes, we have these extraordinary progressive luminaries, but we also have former Reagan ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock. We have Andrew Bacevich, who is both a contributor to The Nation and the American Conservative, and John Dean, I don't know where people may remember him, as a former Nixon White House counsel, who's been very strong. He's been very strong, and people watch him on TV, in addressing the threats to our democracy from Russian interference in elections. So I think we've put together a group, which that's why we call it Common Ground. We've tried to find ways to come together in a transpartisan way and to address these challenges.
I somehow doubt that Trump was very influenced by a letter spearheaded by you and other progressives on that list, and yet it almost sounded like it. On the way into the summit this morning, you probably saw Trump made some brief remarks to reporters on his way in a few hours ago, and I think, to me, to my ear, the biggest story that came out of that little tete-a-tete with reporters was the degree to which the president emphasized the nuclear weapons issue when that had not been a focus of his or a media focus leading up to it. Here's 18 seconds of what he said.
And I really think the world wants to see us get along. We are the two great nuclear powers. We have 90% of the nuclear, and that's not a good thing. It's a bad thing. And I think we hopefully can do something about that, because it's not a positive force. It's a negative force.
So, Katrina, were you surprised to hear that this morning?
You know, I'm not, because this summit was always designed to be a small steps summit. I don't mean that progress on nuclear arms control agreements is small steps, but the Russia watchers see this as an agenda, you know, the summit with small expectations, loose agenda. and always thought that if there was some movement forward, even with Trump's anything but Obama, anything Obama did is bad fixation, that it would be extending the START nuclear arms treaty. And I think we're hearing that from him. That's the most hopeful thing that could come out of this. And I think even Russia watchers who are rightly worried that Trump might cut deals on Syria and all, you know, Crimea, which I never believed was in the cards, always thought that the START nuclear agreement might be the centerpiece. But, you know, listen, one of the problems, Brian, is we're living at a time where, you know, I mean, Trump, his reckless machinations as he bullied his way across Europe are, you know, we understand how destructive he is. But I would argue that the bipartisan foreign establishment, the bipartisan establishment consensus on foreign policy that has, you know, basically defined our role in the world for decades, is bankrupt. And I think we need to find a way, third way. I think many of the people who signed the Nation letter, many of those who write for the Nation, understand the recklessness, the destructiveness, the disruptive Trump policies, but also seek a way that is not designed by the failures of our last decades, whether it was Iraq or global trade agreements written for corporations. A whole set of things need to be rethought, and this is a moment when we need the right kind of disruption and a disruption of the steady militarization of U.S. foreign policy, which is what NATO is all about.
Let me apologize in advance that we're going to have to
cut
you off here.
Trump always messes things up. He does.
Your media appearances included. So this is this.
Thank you.
You know, it keeps
Brian.
Looking like it's going to start momentarily, but let's keep going as long as we could keep going. They seem to be checking the microphones there. Your letter.
Putin is always notoriously late. I saw that he came 50 minutes late to the meeting with Trump.
Well, this news conference was supposed to happen an hour ago. Your letter was published before Friday's indictments by Mueller of 11 Russian intelligence agents for specifically hacking into Democratic Party servers in 2016 and using the stolen information to help Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. But your letter almost takes the Trump and Putin position of uncertainty that Russia even hacked at all. It says America's digital age infrastructure needs urgent protection. Quote, whatever the truth of varied charges that Russia interfered with the election, unquote. So do you doubt the truth of that more than Mueller or all the U.S. intelligence services? And I understand your criticism in your last answer of the U.S. intelligence establishment from decades and decades.
Well, it's not just the intelligence establishment, it's the bipartisan foreign policy establishment.
Right.
But I do think, I believe that Russia meddled. Was there collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia? That still needs to be proven. And I think what's important is that the integrity of the Mueller investigation be protected. But I think, and this is very difficult to talk about, Brian, because you get vilified. You're called a traitor. This must be called out, the Russian meddling in our elections. But we should not be the immaculate country without sin. I mean, Carnegie Mellon's study of last year showed the United States has interfered in about 80 elections at post-World War II, didn't even include Iran and Chile. So that's not, I don't want to do a whataboutism. I really don't. I think we need to take these charges of Russian meddling very seriously. I don't like it, and I think it's a big mistake when people describe these the assault on our elections or the meddling as akin to Pearl Harbor or 9/11, because that suggests military response in response. What we need to do, it seems to me, is understand how the peril of our election infrastructure. And Brian, it's not just Russian meddling. I would submit it's dark money flowing through our polluted system, voter suppression, which the Republicans and Trump continue to drive to keep people from voting. And it's also voter registration records and horrific old, unaudited systems of voting without paper ballots. We should have, after Bush v. Gore, taken serious steps. Now maybe we could. There's talk of a Geneva Convention for cybersecurity. We need as much protection, but not these calls of vilification for those who raise questions of America's meddling, nor for calls of war as a result of Russian meddling in our election.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation and publisher of a letter signed by many progressive luminaries last week leading into this summit, asking them to focus not just, asking really the American side to focus not just on election meddling, but also on improving relations with Russia if possible to avoid the potential for nuclear war. As we give you blow by blow of what's happening in Helsinki, in the room where the media has congregated, they've now asked people to take their seats. So I imagine they'll be starting any time now with Trump and Putin's news conference. In the meantime, Katrina, and whatever time we have left, did the Mueller indictment, naming all those names and attributing the operation to the Russian state, change your view in any way?
I've always believed that the investigation needs to come to its full conclusion, and this is a major step on the road to that. It is not concluded. We have not seen Americans named. There are likely to be, as it's the term is, unindicted co-conspirators, Americans. There were allegations of Americans. So I'm just saying I think we need to let it run its course, and the constant attacks on it. You know, a lot of what Trump was doing in Europe and continues to do in Helsinki is really for domestic politics, Brian. It's to speak to his base. It's to, you know, attack European allies as free riders. It's to attack this and, you know, to attack Brexit or support Brexit. But I think, you know, the bottom line remains that it's neither pro-Trump nor pro-Putin to seek a working relationship, not friendship, not deep, loving partnership, a working relationship with Syria to resolve the nuclear issue, to find a way to stabilize Syria, which is destabilizing Europe, sadly, with horrific refugee flows, to find a way to resolve the Ukrainian crisis, where you still have so much violence and people are being killed, and there is a peace process that could be driven forward. So there are a set of issues that really need attention. And I'd like to say that the open letter was published on Saturday in Russia's leading oppositionist anti-Putin newspaper. This is where the journalists have been killed over the last years, Anna Politkovskaya. The newspaper published it as a statement of solidarity with those in this country who both understand the dangers of Putinism as an authoritarian leader, but also understand the dangers of a new Cold War, which I have seen in the 35 years I've been reporting from Russia, how Cold War narrows and closes space for dissent, dissenting voices, and empowers the worst forces in both countries, profiteers, bloated defense budgets, war parties. So I think it's imperative to understand as progressives also what this does to strip, you know, what we can, defense budgets, what we need to rebuild our country, and not to vilify dissent as linked to a foreign power, which we've seen too much of. That is an old trope that is dangerous.
On Ukraine and Crimea, are you close to the Trump position that
no.
Crimea and Eastern, let me just articulate it so our listeners know, that Crimea and Eastern Ukraine generally are largely ethnically Russian, would just as soon be governed by Russia, and therefore NATO should not make a thing of it?
Well, I think what NATO I think NATO, by the way, you know, was designed to keep Russia out, Germany down, and the U.S. in. But the thing that NATO needs to do is focus, I think, now, not the expansion of NATO would simply exacerbate an already perilously bad relationship. What I was saying on Ukraine is your listeners may not know, but there is a peace process called Minsk, and it's signed on to by France, Germany, Ukraine, and Russia. I think the United States could usefully get involved in trying to resolve so that there's more autonomy for eastern Ukraine, which is more ethnically Russian, but also bring peace to a country which has been, you know, just torn and ravaged by ongoing civil war. But Ukraine must be independent. It is an independent country of great history, and I think NATO expansion, and it should be a bridge. It should be non-aligned. It should join with the EU and the Russian Economic Association. So the Crimea, if relations were better, the UN should hold a UN-monitored referendum, a second referendum. But I think that's out of the cards, and I think no movement is going to be made. There was a lot of talk about Trump giving back Crimea. He has no right to. And that's not happening, and the sanctions are in place, held down by Congress. So there's no movement. I do think the danger is the growing Israeli-Russian relationship, which could very well lead to an isolation of Iran, with Russia restraining Iran and Syria, which is not a bad thing. But The danger of war with Iran, in my view, is one of the underreported problems, because this Trump administration is unified on that. Israel is pushing it, as is Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And The New Yorker has done a good reporting piece about this kind of collaboration. That needs more attention.
Right. And at the same time, one of the U.S.'s beefs with Russia is that Russia, by empowering Assad in Syria and the Iranian alliance with Assad in Syria, including military presence, is strengthening Iran's hand when it is still responsible for a lot of the terrorism, quote unquote, in the world and destabilizing that region in many respects, right?
I think that the one of the grave, there are many crises of this administration, the Trump administration. One was abandoning the Paris Climate Accord, but the other was the Iran nuclear deal. That Iran nuclear deal was a tight, tough diplomatic negotiation, and the unraveling of it, Brian, will do more to destabilize the region than any alleged, you know, Iranian activities. Certainly Iran is not immaculate by any conception, but it could play a stabilizing role. And Israel, the United States, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia determined that it not.
And the Trump administration, when we talk about the profundity of the changes in U.S. foreign policy since he took office, all of these international things, you mentioned climate Paris Accords.
Yes.
You know, he wants to get out of the World Trade Organization, he says. You see how he's dissing NATO, though I understand your critiques of NATO. TPP, though I certainly understand your critiques of foreign trade for corporate benefit. But he just doesn't seem to believe in international institutions.
You know, again, he's playing to his base. There's a long tradition in the Republican Party of a kind of nationalist, reactionary isolationism. I reject the notion, by the way, that the U.S. is faced with a choice between isolationism and the old elite consensus. This is where I, you know, come down on saying we need to renegotiate these trade agreements, but not to the right or to the ethnic nationalist right, as Donald Trump would, but they have been written for corporations, not for people. But the danger is, at this moment, Brian, it is a very tricky, trying, vexing, vertiginous moment. Donald Trump wins the morning, by the way, every morning with his tweets, as Politico might say. He defines the news agenda for too many. But we need to understand that they're first principles, and that, again, I come back, rejecting the notion between isolationism and the old elite consensus. Let's find a new way forward that is not about the steady militarization of U.S. foreign policy, which Donald Trump, by the way, with his demand that NATO now countries pay 4% of GDP. I mean, essentially, he's a huckster for American arms manufacturers, because a lot of those NATO countries would have to buy U.S. arms. But we need less military, more smart thinking, more tough diplomacy to address the real security concerns from catastrophic climate change to a global economy rigged to foster extreme inequality, which corrupts democracy here and abroad.
You know what,
so
I think
that
what else
the
I think?
The kleptocracy element, by the way, is very interesting, because I think Mueller is draining the swamp. I mean, you know, Manafort, the industrial consultant complex. But I think, you know, you have leaders of two plutocracies, so to speak, meeting in Helsinki right now. As Jimmy Carter has said, America, you know, is becoming an oligarchy, and Donald Trump is monetizing American power and a reflection of that oligarchy as he bullies his way across Europe.
And when you talk about draining the swamp or not draining the swamp, Trump is blaming these other countries that he's imposing tariffs on for you know, the problems, some of the economic problems here with jobs, but he seems to have stopped blaming any of the corporations who actually choose to ship those jobs overseas, and stopped saying, as he did a little bit during his campaign, that he would punish them if they continued to do that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's an incoherence to this tariff policy. If he was serious, first of all, you'd need to bring on Europe. And secondly, you'd need an industrial policy to create real jobs with decent wages. What we see instead is he's, you know, his policies continue in a curious way, a kind of inverse right-wing neoliberal policy generating rising inequality and creating an economy that does not work for working people. So again, that's a model that needs to be fought for, but it's not on the Trump agenda, even with his constant speaking out for working people. His policies are actually shafting them.
Well, since they're still not starting,
Putin, he is notoriously late. I mean, but let me just say one last thing, because I do think there is such a kind of, glorification of the, quote, post-World War II liberal order. And there are some extraordinary institutions that were created, the United Nations, which the Trump administration was the, I don't know if people saw this, but last week there was a global migration pact, which the UN had worked on for several years. The United States was the only nation which voted against it. It was 192-1. That may be a precedent, but the Trump administration with John Bolton, Nikki Haley, is determined to destroy an institution that at its best could play a role in avoiding war. An endless war, I submit, is a scourge of our country. I mean, you think of Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history. Trump campaigned against endless war, falsely, rhetorically. But I think Americans may not be anti-war, but the opposition to endless war and the possibility of a foreign policy of restraint, realism, diplomacy is something that a wise leader, I hope, in the Democratic Party would pick up and run with.
Since they haven't started yet, let me get your take on something Trump said in Europe. We'll see if they walk onto stage as soon as I start this clip. But of course, he told Theresa May how to implement Brexit, but she wouldn't listen, he said, and that was remarkable. And then he also lectured them on immigration. Listen.
I think what's happened to Europe is a shame. I think the immigration, allowing the immigration to take place in Europe is a shame. I think it changed the fabric of Europe. And unless you act very quickly, it's never going to be what it was. And I don't mean that in a positive way. So I think allowing millions and millions of people to come in to Europe is very, very sad. I think you're losing your culture.
I think you're losing your culture. That was one of the most remarkable moments to me. Trump explicitly saying he's, you know, not opposed to immigration just for anti-terrorism or anti-crime reasons, which
but
is what we
cultural
use.
Cultural reasons.
Cultural purity. It's white supremacy.
In that statement, you're right, Brian, he became the American repository lecturer, hectorer in defense of a kind of white supremacist politics, ethno-reactionary, xenophobic. It's appalling. It's despicable. I wish that the two women Trump had really bullied had spoken back forcefully. Angela Merkel did it in her quiet way. She's under siege in her own country. Theresa May, maybe not possible. She's already been subjected to the shambolic bullying of Boris Johnson, who, thank God, left as foreign minister last week. But what Trump did in that statement is a reflection. It revealed who he is, and Europe should take this moment to craft a more independent policy and position and stand up to Trump. It was sort of sad to see that I guess they feel that Trump is America, so you can't. But I think it's time to stand up to this administration because his values do not reflect what is at the heart of the American project at its best, the unceasing quest for a more perfect union, for equality before the law, for the four freedoms, for other important aspects of what's truly great about this nation, though I don't believe in exceptionalism of a kind.
and I get what I think is your great contribution to this whole national conversation, which is to, you know, be tough on Russian hacking and everything Trump that deserves being tough on, but not to lose sight of the history over decades of the imperialist, if you want to call it that, U.S. foreign policy establishment, and not to lionize them beyond what they deserve. But it's a contradiction what we were just talking about. Trump thinks he and Putin are saving Western civilization when Putin's main goal is to destroy it.
I don't believe, I'm sorry, I think Putin is an authoritarian leader, but I don't think his main goal is to destroy it. I think, listen, who was the first leader to call, to come to the United States' assistance after 9/11? Putin. He called George W. He facilitated pathways to assist our troops in Afghanistan. He didn't pull out of the ABM treaty in 2002. George W. with John Bolton by his side did, and it began to unravel this arms control architecture. I think there are many issues with Putin. Authoritarian, there's a repression in his country. He is violating norms of international law. But at the same time, for Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations to tweet out, as he did the other day, something about four centuries of international, I don't know, order, and Russia's the first to interfere. I'm paraphrasing, forgive me. Mm-hmm. But come on. I mean, our country is a great country, but I'm not going to tick off where we haven't done right. But it's not just anti-imperialism. It's just common sense and history. I mean, history, as someone once said, history is to a nation what memory is to an individual. Former Nation contributing editor used to say the United States was the U.S. of amnesia. I don't want my country to be the U.S. of amnesia. And all these people lionizing these decades after World War II as great, 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 you need to give the full picture if you're going to be authentic and people understand what is great and what is flawed and what we need to rebuild in our country. I think we do greatest by strengthening our democracy at home before we go out to slay and intervene.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. We thank Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Thought-provoking as always. Let's continue to continue this conversation in
thank
future
you,
appearances. Thank you very much.